Good morning. The first case on docket is Spitter v. Craig, number C-5499. When counsel begins, if they please note their appearance for the record. And if you wish to reserve...
My name is Carl Hebert and I represent appellant Scott Spitter.
Okay, and if you wish to reserve any time, please note it comes out of your base time.
I understand, Your Honor. May I start?
Yes.
May it please the court, Your Honor. Your Honors. Since 1988, this court has had a litigation malpractice tolling rule. One of the elements of legal malpractice is damages. In 1988, this court in Semenza v. NMLI said that as long as damages are uncertain, a cause of action for legal malpractice does not accrue, including after an appeal. The court said, it follows that a legal malpractice action does not accrue until the plaintiff's damages are certain and not contingent on the outcome of an appeal. That rule has been in place since 1988. In 1997, the Nevada legislature amended NRS 11.207 to have a four-year outside period of limitations and an inside two-year period of limitations after discovery of facts, which would lead to the discovery of the malpractice cause of action. After 1997, in 2002, in Hewitt versus Allen, without mentioning the 1997 amendments, this court reaffirmed the litigation malpractice tolling rule and said that when the underlying case is not over until the appeal is concluded and the damages are uncertain and the cause of action does not accrue until the appeal has been decided. That was Hewitt versus Allen. Later, not too long ago, I think in 2013, this court also discussed litigation malpractice tolling and transactional malpractice tolling in Moon versus McDonald Corano, both of which cases I was counsel in. In the meantime, Judge Sattler in the Second Judicial District Court granted summary judgment against Mr. Spitler based on the argument that Mr. Spitler knew that the malpractice cause of action in the underlying case here accrued in 2010 when he replaced his trial counsel. However, the case was on appeal at that point, and the appeal in the underlying case was not decided until 2013. And then about approximately a month, maybe 2 months after the appeal was decided, the malpractice action that we're talking about here today was filed by my predecessor counsel. And then Judge Sattler dismissed or granted summary judgment and said to Mr. Spitler, you knew that malpractice had occurred back when you replaced your counsel in 2010. The Nevada legislature in 1997 implicitly did away with litigation malpractice tolling and granted summary judgment against Mr. Spitler. That brings us to Brady versus New Albertsons in 2014, in which this court again reaffirmed the litigation malpractice tolling rule and said that it lives on. And the reason it lives on, quoting from this court, quote, when the litigation in which the malpractice occurred continues to progress, the material facts that pertain to the damages still evolve as the acts of the offending attorney may increase, decrease or eliminate the damages the malpractice caused. Hence the need for the litigation malpractice tolling rule remains as it permits the litigation to end and the damages to become certain before judicial resources are invested in entertaining the malpractice action. And what recommends the litigation malpractice rule to this court is certainty. We know when the underlying case ends, typically. It's much more certain than the continuous representation rule, which the respondents are now advocating. The continuous representation rule says, if a claim for legal malpractice accrues while the attorney continues to represent the client, then the legal malpractice cause of action is tolled until the representation ends. Well, in this case, because the damages were uncertain until the appeal was concluded in 2013, the litigation malpractice rule wouldn't apply because the cause of action didn't accrue until long after the respondents were discharged as attorneys. So the continuous representation rule doesn't apply, but and there are good policy reasons why it shouldn't apply. One of which is when does the representation end? What was the scope of the representation? Was the representation continuous or did it stop and start? These are all issues that trial courts will have to struggle with if the court abandons the litigation malpractice tolling rule, which we've had for almost 20 years, and goes to the continuous representation rule. But what it comes down to is this. One of the elements of a legal malpractice cause of action is damages. Damages are uncertain until the appeal is concluded. Therefore, the cause of action doesn't accrue. That rule continues to survive despite the amendment to the 11.207, and it was reaffirmed in Brady versus New Albertsons, and there's no reason to overturn that rule now.
Now, Brady was entered, about 6 months after the order by Judge Sattler in this case?
Your Honor?
Wasn't Brady was in August, I believe, of 14. I think your order was it February or March? It was earlier that year.
March.
The findings of fact, conclusions of law in the underlying case were entered in April of 2010. Notice of entry of judgment, 2010. Legal malpractice complaint was filed in August of 2013, 4 months after the order of affirmance. Was that the court's question?
No, it was the summary judgment was entered by Judge Sattler in this case in March, I believe it was March of 14, and the Brady versus New Albertsons was in the summer of 14.
I'm sorry.
My point is that Judge Sattler didn't have the benefit of the Brady case at the time he made his decision. And I was just wondering how much that impacted his ruling from your point of view.
He brought respondents' arguments, Your Honor. I'll grant you that. And by the way, I apologize for missing the question. The order granting summary judgment was March 13, 2014, and Brady was August 7. So we're talking about 4 months. But it wasn't like Judge Sattler was clueless about what the existing state of Nevada law was. There was Hewitt versus Allen, primarily, but there was Semenza versus NMLI. The significance, I suppose, is that legislature amended the statute in 97, but that still left Hewitt versus Allen in 2002. He should have been bound by that decision, which says no accrual until the appeal is over. If the court has no further questions, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Joe Guerin, and I'm here for respondents, attorneys, and law firm. Just kind of to go over the procedure in this case, what happened was there was underlying litigation. Mr. Spittler lost in February 2010. My clients were then terminated and replaced in April. April 15, 2010, successor counsel took over. There were post-trial motions that were filed and decided. And the new attorney, successor counsel, filed a notice of appeal on August 13, 2010. On April 24, 2013, more than 3 years after my clients were fired, Nevada Supreme Court affirmed the trial court's decision that was adverse to Mr. Spittler. And it was on August 29, 2013, that this legal malpractice case was first filed against my clients. So that's 3.5 years after they were terminated.
Counsel, even with those facts, why does not the trilogy of cases that have been highlighted by counsel control in this matter?
Very, very simply, Your Honor. If you look at the statute when it was in effect before 1997, there were two things that had to coalesce before the clock started ticking on the statute of limitations. The first one is the claimant had to have an awareness of the material facts that constitute the cause of action. And this is important. There's a conjunction in the statute that says, and sustains damages. Plaintiff has to sustain damages.
We understand that, but I guess the issue on hand, and I guess maybe that is from our standpoint, and you can convince us otherwise, where the judge went off the tracks, but there's an issue of tolling during this appeal period. Why does that not come into play?
There's a couple reasons, Your Honor. First, if you look at the statute the way it was before the amendment, the tolling rule made sense because it said and sustained damages. So Semenza, NMLI, it makes perfect sense. The 2002 case, the Hewitt case, that's a little bit off the rails. because the case had nothing to do with the statute of limitations. There was no argument regarding the application of NRS 11.207, which is the statute of limitations for legal malpractice. Instead, the spin-out was that based on these older cases before the amendment, the underlying litigation had to be completed. And so that's where the litigation tolling, that's where this kind of came up. But the second more significant reason why litigation tolling shouldn't exist is it's not in the statute. The only basis to toll a cause of action or a legal malpractice cause of action against an attorney is for concealment. And in May of 2014, this court decided Libby versus Hamilton, which was a medical malpractice case. And in that case, the plaintiff, the patient, was arguing for a tolling exception based on the presence of a foreign body. And what happened was she had a suture structure that was somewhere in her body that had a MRSA, MRSA infection. And it wasn't discovered until 3 years after the surgery. And what her attorney argued was, well, she didn't know it was there, so there should be some kind of tolling because of this foreign body. And he cited to California cases in the California statute, which expressly includes that. Well, this court rejected that and said, we're not going to imply a tolling exception that doesn't exist in the statute. It says, because the Nevada legislature has not codified a tolling provision similar to the foreign body exception in California, we reject the argument. So in this case, there is no express tolling provision for litigation that's contained in the statute. This is a judicially created exception. And for that reason, we think that the court's decision granting summary judgment in this case was appropriate.
Would we have to overrule Brady if we agreed with your argument, Mr. Guerin?
On that thin slice, yes, but there's a way to do it in a way that's consistent with existing precedent, and that is to adopt the continuous representation rule. Now, the court's recognized it in the Moon case. The court recognized it and recognized the distinction. In Brady versus Vorek, footnote 6, the court says, this may exist, but we're not answering that question today. But if you look at the continuous representation rule, what it means is we've got litigation tolling, and the whole policy behind that is that it gives the opportunity for certainty of damages, but it also gives the attorney the opportunity to clean up the mess he may have made. Now, if the attorney's terminated, he can't clean up the mess. Someone else is controlling it. And as in this case, where there's no dispute that Mr. Spittler was aware of the material facts when he fired my clients, there's no reason for the continuous representation rule not to apply. So in other words, he was aware of the material facts that constitute the cause of action. My clients were fired. They didn't have the opportunity to clean up the mess. And in fact, successor counsel who took over, he filed a notice of appeal, he filed an initial brief, and that was it. There was no reply brief, it was decided without arguments, and my clients had absolutely no control over that. So the idea behind the litigation tolling rule, the policy behind it that justifies it, it's not present here. My clients were terminated. Mr. Spittler had actual knowledge, and the court found this, there was no evidence below to refute any of it, actual knowledge of the material facts that constitute the cause of action. He lost the case. And that's the malpractice that he wanted to pursue against them now. And so because of that, because there's a clear line of demarcation, the attorneys are terminated and the client has an absolute awareness of the malpractice, at that point, all the policy reasons behind the statute of limitations, such as preservation of evidence, pursuing claims before they get stale and certainty of results, all of those reasons justify it. Now, if they file it and they want to pursue
it. But you also, under the theory you're putting forth, there's another issue, and that is having dual litigation, because that malpractice claim that you're talking about, or potential malpractice claim, is still an open item. It is not final. And so you have this new litigation where prior attorneys or present attorneys are being sued for malpractice. At the same time, this other underlying action has not come to final to finality as to damages or whatever. It's uncertain. The appellate rights haven't run or anything else. So why is that not problematic?
Well, that can be dealt with by a stay in the trial court. But at least the attorneys have the opportunity to go out and try and preserve and gather evidence before it gets stale, before witnesses die. In Brady, the actual one of the parties died. Well, the underlying case was still pending.
I think your opponent's probably going to come back and say that if the appeal had been successful and the judgment was reversed, then it'd be moot at that stage, something like that. What would your response to that be?
The response to that is that it gives successor counsel the ability to control the tail that's laying on top of the prior attorney. So however they decide to prosecute the claim or prosecute the appeal, they can delay it, they can slow it down, they can accelerate it. But at least by giving them notice of the malpractice claim, it levels the playing field for the defendant attorneys. And they can at least have the opportunity to try and go out and preserve evidence and know that this claim is out there, as opposed to 3.5 years later saying, oh, wow, we got sued. We didn't handle the appeal. What happened? And then it's a matter of trying to put it all back together. The other thing, too, is if the attorneys are on notice that they might get sued, perhaps they have some input. And they can say to successor counsel, you know what, you might want to consider this. You might want to consider this argument, or you might want to try this angle. But that doesn't happen if they're fired and there's no contact and they have no knowledge that there's a potential malpractice claim that's going to come up later. So I think that that's kind of the strong reason why. But again, back to your question, I think that it can be dealt with on a stay basis. And that was recognized, I think, in the Gonzalez case or in Copico, where the court in a footnote said, well, a stay can be put in place on the malpractice case. And at least at that point, the attorneys have notice. They could ask the court for relief so that they can take depositions or try and do things to preserve evidence, which is one of the policies behind the statute of limitations, as opposed to 3.5 years later trying to put it all back together. So that's kind of the gist of the argument, unless you have further questions.
Can I just add one on the basis of the case? I know it's not the issue today, but as far as the basis of the malpractice claim was the law firm recording the list pendants on the neighbor's property.
Correct.
That's what started
it. That's kind of the essence of it. We really didn't get into the specifics because we filed the motion and it was granted pretty much from the outset.
Okay.
But that, I think, was the general allegation.
I see. Okay.
Mr. Sherry, anything?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Skipping around somewhat, Your Honors, one of the arguments made by counsel for the respondent was the litigation tolling rule is not in the statute. Well, neither are the elements of the cause of action for legal malpractice, neither is latches, equitable tolling, a lot of the things that this court fills in for the legislature and through the common law, that's not in the statute either. So that argument has no weight. Dual litigation, which was raised by Justice Douglas, this court has commented on the possibility of dual litigation in Semenza versus NMLI, quote, more importantly, however, this court will not countenance interlocutory type actions in legal malpractice brought to trial while an appeal of the underlying case is still pending. I mean, this court for 20 years has had solid authority that as long as the case survives, including on appeal, there's a chance to correct these issues. And maybe the case goes away in the underlying court, in the underlying action. But what counsel proposes is going to complicate the landscape considerably. We're going to have issues of what do we do with the concurrently filed malpractice action. And one point he's talking about a stay, and another point he's talking about depositions to preserve evidence. The continuing representation rule is unnecessary. We don't need another tolling scheme in this state. We've got litigation malpractice tolling. We don't need an overlay of the continuing representation rule.
But I think counsel made a point, though. It seemed to make some sense. If the law firm's not handling the appeal, they don't control the appeal, they don't control the arguments. Apparently the law firm didn't file a reply brief for whatever reason in the appeal of that other case. Isn't that prejudicial, though, to the law firm, you know, when they're out of it and they've been terminated and they have nothing further they can do as far as the processing of the appeal?
If they're very concerned, their malpractice insurer could step in and intervene in the appeal and take over the brief writing if that's their concern. But, I mean, how far do we go to protect potential malpractice defendants? I mean, judicial economy and judicial resources is at the heart of litigation malpractice tolling. Why should this court and the lower courts be processing malpractice actions when the problem could be solved in the underlying case on appeal? And that's the crux of the issue, and that's what this court has sustained all the way through Brady versus New Albertson.
What's your answer to the question? Would we have to overrule Brady versus New Albertsons, at least overrule it in part if we agreed with the respondent on this particular case?
Absolutely. I mean, the Brady versus New Albertsons decision took on the argument proposed by counsel for the respondent head on. But like Lazarus, here it is again. It's time to put this to rest. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. This matter will stand submitted. Thank counsel for their arguments this day and interesting issue. Thank you.